So now we're going to have a talk in a couple of minutes' time. So if you'd like to get yourselves comfortable while the girls in the back room get this loaded so it can be streamed live all over the world, our Father's Mass, so any extraterrestrial life can also listen to the Dhamma this evening. Very good. So some coming in, some going out. It's getting nice and warm in here now. The best heaters are human beings. Actually, I'm not really concerned with the cold. Ever since I heard that one of the practices in Tibetan Buddhism was to prepare a person so that they could withstand the very, very intense cold of the mountains in the high plateaus of Tibet, they trained in developing this inner heat through meditation to be able to create heat from within the body. And when they were able to do this, they were given the test. And the test was that you had to go out into the snow fields in the middle of the night. And you had to take all your robes off and sit meditation all night in the snow fields with the wind howling. But you were allowed to wear a blanket. But the blanket was dipped in the icy waters of the lake first and wrapped around you. And you had to dry 3 blankets during the night time to pass the test. And every time I feel cold, I think of that, and I don't feel cold anymore. That's my trick. That'd be terrible. But anyway, the talk this evening is not on cold, it's on arguments, because I feel very sad that one of my monks goes on the forum. It's one of the things which the Buddhist Society of Western Australia offers. You can ask all these questions and argue with one of the monks. And the arguments go on and on and on, and they're endless, just like in your life. Now, have you argued with a person you love this week or maybe an hour ago? Why do we do that? And so today we're going to talk about arguments. What are they and how to overcome them? And also in the end, if you want to find out what the real truth is, arguments are not the way to get to the truth. And I'll explain why. But first of all, you know, when we have arguments, it's just really so unpleasant because no one listens to the other person. They only listen to themselves. So if you're arguing with someone, don't think you're convincing them at all. They're not listening to you. They're just thinking of the next reason why they can refute you and turn you over and just totally sort of give you another point of view, which makes what you say totally wrong. And in Buddhism, I was really impressed that once the Buddha said, I don't argue with anyone. People argue with me, but I don't argue with anyone. And that was a very powerful statement. How can you actually do that? So what most people mean by arguments is when we contest points of view, my point of view against your point of view. And you'll always know, if you're not wise, that you are always right and the other person is always wrong. That's obvious, isn't it? And even I was reading Socrates. He said that's actually, you can never think you're wrong. It's impossible to think you're wrong. You can think you were wrong, but at the time, even if you think you were wrong, you think you're right about that. And if you work it out, it's actually the nature that you always think, perceive you are right. And when you understand that, you understand a deep reason why people argue. But the other thing is, once we argue, just our society doesn't allow us to be wrong. And to be wrong is one of these great stigmas, to be proved wrong. And that's what a wonderful thing it is when you're wrong for the first time and admit it. It means you don't have to to struggle so hard to be right ever again. It's like when I failed my first exam, I realised, why didn't I fail this earlier? It was such a relief to fail, because to always succeed was just so much pressure and so much stress. So all your teenage boys and girls going to school, fail your exams as early as you possibly can. Because if you pass them, you'll have to do another one next year, and another one the year after, and another one the year after, until when you actually fail, then you can be free. So I was telling a lot of people, look, if you want to be happy in life, lower your expectations. That's very profound, you know. Lower your expectations of yourself and others so you don't have to live up to such high standards. In other words, lower your expectations to who you are rather than who you want to be. And lower the expectations of your partner to who he or she is rather than who you want them to be. That's what I call about lowering your expectations. Lowering your expectations about always being right. Just have this society, this group, which demands the freedom to be wrong. Because it's wonderful to be wrong. Because when you say you're wrong, people won't argue with you anymore. They think you're stupid. And then you can have a nice, peaceful life. So, number one, it's okay to be wrong. But really, there is no one who was right and no one who is wrong. I always remember my great teacher, Ajahn Chah, whenever there was an argument and people would come and see him, he would always say to them, he said, the first person, you're right, but not correct. The other person, you're correct, but not right. And that was actually a very beautiful way of saying things, because it wasn't saying that one person was totally right, the other person was totally wrong, because they never are. We're always halfway in between being right and wrong. And that's what we call in Buddhism the middle way. So when people say you're wrong, say, no, I'm not wrong. Said, but I'm not correct either. When they which means that you're understanding something very profound about the reason why people argue. It's because we take what we think, what we see, our experience, we take that to be more than it truly is. It's a half-truth. It'll always be only a half-truth. And unfortunately, I can't go past the classic Buddhist story, which many of you have heard before, but if you really understood this, and you remembered this, and you practiced this, you wouldn't have an argument ever again. And that's the argument about, you know, the old elephant and the seven blind men. Elephant and seven blind men. The elephant, there's actually an addition to the story, which I'll tell you later on. There was the elephant and the seven blind men. This king was always having trouble with his politicians, always arguing. And that was actually said in the Udana, one of the Buddhist scriptures, 26 centuries ago. There are some things in life which never change. Politicians always arguing. Kids never doing what their parents tell them to do. Wives and husbands always arguing. What they say, that great story, in the first year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the second year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the third year of marriage, the neighbours listen to both of them. Because they're arguing really loud as well. But there's some things never change. But with the elephant and the seven blind men, the king had it up to here with all his ministers arguing. They never got anything done. Have you ever noticed when you're arguing how much time you waste and how much emotional capital and how much health you destroy? And happiness, you just throw away. It's just not worth it. So, he wanted to teach them a lesson. He gave them this object lesson, these ministers. He found seven men who'd been blind since the time they were born and took them into this big arena and made them feel an elephant. The first person felt the elephant's trunk. The next one felt the ears. The next one felt the tusks. The next one felt the head. The next one felt the body, one felt the legs, and the other one felt the tail. And they said, what is an elephant? And the first one said, you know, feeling the tusks, it was a plough. which the farmers use to dig the earth. Because imagine you're blind and you're feeling this very strong curved thing with a point at the end. It'd be great to plough the earth. Said it's a plough. I'm sure of it. I can feel it. It's my direct experience. I can feel it, okay? I know what I'm talking about. And the one who felt the ears says, you're an idiot. You can't dig the earth with this. It's flat, it's soft, and it goes back and forwards. It's a fan, which the king uses to cool himself. It's a fan, not a plough, you idiot. No way, said the guy who felt the trunk. It's a snake, like a python, because that's what it feels like, you doofus. It can't be anything else than that. Absolutely impossible, said the one who felt the head. It was a water pot. The one who felt the body said it was a big rock. The one who felt the legs, it was a tree trunk. Yeah, really solid tree trunk. No way, it's a fly whisk, said the guy who felt the tail. And they all argued about what it was because they had their own personal experience. They weren't wrong, but they weren't right either. They only had half the truth or a part of the truth. So what they did, once they were wise, once they'd listened to these podcasts on the internet, broadcast wide, they never argued anymore. What they did, what they should have done to begin with, is sit down and combine their experience. And then these seven blind men would have come up with a solution. An elephant is this big boulder on four tree trunks with a water pot on the front, a higher bit. And on either side of the water pot is two fans with a snake in the middle. On either side of the snake, two ploughs with a fly whisk on the back. That's not a bad description of an elephant for someone who'll never see it. And that's why, instead of arguing, it'll be much better if people of different religions or no religions or ideas would actually sit down and combine their ideas and information and their holy books and their experiences and their religious experience. Wouldn't it be wonderful if they combined their experiences rather than fought over them and argued? We actually might be able to learn a bit more closely what an elephant is. But I can't resist saying the extension of that story, the modern version of that story, because sometimes all these things are anthropocentric, whatever it is. But that one especially was just seven blind men. What about the girls? But even more than the girls, what about the elephants? So once there were seven blind elephants. And the seven blind elephants were arguing of what a human being was. They'd heard the word human being, but they'd never seen a human being. So they decided, how can we find out what a human being truly is? So we won't argue about it. So they all decided to feel a human being. So they all felt a human being each. And they all decided, they concurred, that a human being was flat. An elephant feeling a human being. Squash. Well, the elephants got it right. They never argued. So why can't husbands and wives do that? A lot of times, is it because of this personal involvement of being right and not allowed to be wrong? And always this perception that one has to be right. Now, that's one of the things we want to sort of get rid of. You don't have to be right. It's okay to be wrong. And when we give wrong rights to people, in other words, you've got human rights, you've got rights for your sexuality, you've got rights for age, you've got rights for freedom of religion, but the freedom to be wrong, which is not allowed in this world. So I think we should actually do the human rights, add another article. It is a right, you're allowed to be wrong, and you should not feel demeaned or diminished by being wrong, because you are wrong many, many times. In fact, admitting you are wrong is a wonderful thing to do, because it does give you a lot of peace and freedom, as I say. So next time your wife argues with you, just say, yes, you're right, darling. I was the one who was wrong. Imagine what a peaceful life you will have. It is why this was John Updike. He was a playwright and author in England. He said the secret of a happy relationship is if you're wrong, admit it. Admit it. Say it straight away. You can have a very happy relationship. But if you're right, shut up. The secret of a happy relationship. And there's a lot of wisdom to that. So what happens when you're arguing? When you're arguing, you are noticing or you're assuming the primacy of the individual, basically you, over the relationship. That me is more important than us. That's why we argue. And that's one of the reasons why people have a lot of pain and suffering in life. They're just looking at things from the wrong perspective. It's not you which is really important. You don't have to be right or wrong. That's not really important. But are us, are we right or are we wrong? And when you look at it from a different perspective, it's obviously if you've got a partnership there, if you've got friends, if you're sitting around a coffee table talking together, the most important thing is the relationship between you. And when you get an argument which gets vicious and you get emotionally charged, then that is wrong. It doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong, who's got the right idea. The very fact you're arguing and it becomes so emotional and so draining and so much pain, that is what is wrong. So when we have the primacy of relationships rather than the individuals, then it really doesn't matter in the sense that who's got the right information, who's got the wrong information. It's actually how we deal with each other. That is more important than being right or being wrong. In fact, that is what real right, real wrong is. We have to live with each other instead of always being right. Being right is like the intellectual truth. But being in love, being friends, being in harmony together, that's a different type of truth. And that is the truth which should take primacy, the primacy of the relationship, the primacy of being at peace with one another, rather than always being right. So usually in the war of ideas, we sacrifice the most important part of life, the peace and harmony between families and people. Is it really that important, being right as an individual? Or is it more important, you know, having a harmonious, peaceful, wonderful family? What is most important? It's obvious to me, which is why the most of the arguments, you know, the individual, I'm right and you're wrong, no, that's not really important. What's most important is we live in peace and harmony together. Who cares which religion is right if we destroy everybody in the process? Does that really make any sense to you? Of course, it doesn't make any sense to me. It makes life really stupid. So instead of that, we change our priorities to things like peace and harmony, love, rather than always being right. Which is one of the reasons why in Buddhism, if you really look at what somebody like the Buddha said, he said, all I talk about is suffering and the end of suffering. In other words, happiness and how to avoid all the troubles in life. And just trying to find out just the meaning of life, the ideas which you think is going to convince everybody else about the real truth of existence, does that really solve suffering? Or does that make more suffering? To me, many years ago, you had this way of finding out what truth really was, what it has to be. Truth has to be something which created peace and harmony between peoples, not wars, not conflict. If I had an idea, some way of looking at life, some sort of truth, which did create more problems, more difficulties, more disharmony, more violence, that could not be truth. No way it could be truth. I had this wonderful experience of seeing that said by the Buddha when he gave this advice to two people. One was to Upali, his barber, who also became a monk, and also to the first bhikkhuni, the first Buddhist nun, Mahaprajapati. He said, look, you know if it's truth. This is actually how you know it's truth. If it leads to peace and harmony and freedom, it leads to letting go, it leads to enlightenment, the highest happiness. you can know that that must be the truth. Which means that sometimes some of the ideas which people have, does that lead to peace? Does that lead to harmony? Does that lead to freedom? Does that lead to, you know, this really beautiful sense of being at ease with the whole world and with yourself? Does it really lead to that? So truth you can know, not by whether it sounds logical or not, but what it does to you and to the relationships you have with others and the relationships, you know, you have with the world itself. That's where you know whether it's truth or not. Which is why that sometimes when people say, oh, what did the Buddha really teach? Did the Buddha teach reincarnation? Did the real Buddha teach karma? What did the Buddha taught? How do we know what the Buddha taught? Things may have been changed or not. Yes. No, the words can be changed, but does peace ever change? Is peace today, this feeling which you can know in deep meditation, maybe you can touch every now and again in your life, does that feeling ever change over 25 centuries? From girls to boys, to old people, to young people, to Asians, Indians, whoever, does that feeling ever change? And I don't think you can say it does. All those times in your life you've really felt at peace. I'm just thinking now about, not thinking, but remembering. You know, one of those times I remember feeling such peace, because I remember this because it rhymes with the feeling that many of you are very cold. I was visiting one of our monasteries in Sussex, and that day, it was in the newspapers, this was not imagination, that eve night was minus 26 degrees. It doesn't really matter what it was, centigrade or Fahrenheit, that's really cold. And because I remember seeing in the newspapers the following day, they said even the beer froze. Remember, British people like warm beer. That day, even the beer was ice. And I remember just getting up early in the morning, because, you know, I was in Thailand, I used to get up early, just I couldn't really sleep in. That was just my training, my brainwashing, if you like. I got up early in the morning and had a walk through the forest in the snow, in this forest in South England in deep winter on a very, very cold morning. And it was magic. I would never forget that experience, because no one else was up. Only mad monks and Englishmen, and I was both, go out in the morning snow. Everyone else was tucked up in bed or in front of a heater. But I went out and had a walk in the snow. No human being was out. And even better, no animal was out. They were all hibernating. No birds were flying. No little animals were scurrying in the forest floor. It was all snow. And it was like you were alone in the forest, with no sound at all, only the crunch of my boot on the snow. But when I stopped, like the whole universe stopped with me. It was so silent. Nothing moved at all. Nothing stirred. He just stood there, enjoying every moment of incredible stillness. And then he moved a little bit forward, crunching the snow, and stopped again. Whenever I wanted to, I could stop the universe and be absolutely still and peaceful. That was amazing. And those are, you may have had experiences similar to that, but that feeling of peace, that doesn't change from century to century, from culture to culture. And so what the truth is that which generates those feelings of peace and freedom and stillness and joy and happiness, that is what is truth. Which is why when we argue who's right and who's wrong, it doesn't make any sense to me. You're destroying the truth by arguing who's right and who's wrong. Because the truth is something which is, you know, beyond all those words. But truth is something you feel. That's why many years ago I made this statement that if you want to, say, meditate and feel that peace inside of you, you've got to stop all the thinking and you've got to feel your way into truth. I love the way of feeling the way, using your emotions, using your instincts, using your intuition to find out what the truth is. And to this day on, whenever there's a moral problem or an intellectual problem, instead of thinking it through, and I was well trained to think. I was a theoretical physicist from Cambridge. I knew how to use my thinking. But instead, I prefer to feel. Feel what's right and what's wrong. You know, it's much more reliable to find the truth by feeling your way into that truth rather than thinking your way through. Thinking just leads to arguments where we go and fight for the truth. But when you feel it, where's the fighting going? You know that this is truth because this is peace, this leads to harmony, this leads to joy, this leads to freedom. But arguments do not lead to any of those things. So just like in meditation, in a search for truth, please don't try and think your way through. You just argue and get across a brick wall. Feel your way through to what is truth, what is peace. I mean this because sometimes people write books about love. They don't understand a word of what they're saying, which is the trouble with people. Look, it's the thinking your way through it doesn't really lead very far. Feeling your way through means you have to be still, first of all, which is why we teach people to meditate, to stop all this thinking business, and just to be in that space where there are no thoughts. So now, this is an exercise which I love teaching people on meditation retreats, and I'm now going to teach it to you. Some of you have heard this before. As I am speaking, I also want you to be aware of what's going on in your head as I'm speaking. Not just to listen to the words, but listen to the reaction inside your mind. Because as I'm speaking, you will begin to notice some spaces between my words. In those gaps between my words, what was going on in your head? You were, there it was again, silent. You knew without thinking. Isn't that gorgeous? It's a great trick, and please share that with others because it's very effective. You know, for some time, it's the first time they've ever been aware without a thought going on in their head trying to describe it. The trick works because you never knew when I was going to start speaking again. So that's why you were silent, waiting. That's what we mean by truth. That wins the argument because you actually feel what it's like to be free and peaceful and still. There. That's what the Buddha called the Dhamma, the truth. It leads to stillness, it leads to truth. And the answer to the questions, that's where they come from. I don't mean more thoughts. Ah, now this is what that peace was, which people talked about. This is what that sense of freedom really is. And that stillness and that peace is where the arguments all end. At last, you are experiencing this truth. Because when there is a silence, there is a pause, you are not actually doing anything. Unfortunately, it's all this doing stuff which we do, which actually bends the truth. Just like the lake in the mountains, if there is any waves on the surface of that lake, it will not reflect the moon and the stars perfectly. It distorts the image. In this simile, the waves on the surface of the lake represents your thoughts, your ideas. And the lake is your mind. As long as there are those thoughts, those ripples on the lake, you can never really see the truth. You can never feel the truth. The thoughts get in the way. The thoughts are like the static, the ripples on the lake, which stop you seeing things. Which is why that we spend a lot of time as monks and nuns, as Buddhists, as anybody, learning that beautiful stillness and staying in that stillness as long as we possibly can. And there you understand the meaning of life. And from there, you understand all this argument about who's wrong and who's right doesn't make any sense at all. You just let people argue. They can if they want. Sometimes I argue for fun. And when you argue for fun, usually I take the most ridiculous situation. For example, when I was, you know, at Cambridge, there was a society called the Flat Earth Society. It became quite well known. The Flat Earth Society, to be able to join the Flat Earth Society, what you needed to do was to argue why the Earth was flat and not round. And my argument why the Earth was flat, a very logical argument, if the Earth was round, then all the water in the oceans and seas would fall to the bottom. So, you know, it can't be round because we're in Australia. We've got stuff in the bottom. Imagine like a globe. You know, if it's the Earth was a globe, the water falls down to the bottom, doesn't it? I've always seen that. Always happens. So that doesn't happen for the Earth. So it must be flat, because when it's flat, all the water can be nice and level and evil. Evil. So that's my argument, why the Earth must be flat. So I could join the Flat Earth Society. All it really was just showing you can argue anything from any situation if you really wanted to. And one of the purposes for that society was, how can you find the truth through argument when you can argue anything from any point of view sometimes? But sometimes people say, oh no, the truth is the evidence. Gather the evidence and then you will find the truth. And so many people, they base their arguments on evidence. And again, that's going back to the elephant and the seven blind men. How can we ever find all the evidence? And anyway, that's really missing something. Because every now and again, you see things and then you know, that is the truth. That's what love is. That's what all these things are. Instead of thinking it, you feel it. All the major truths of life are never found through books. They're never found through thinking and philosophy. They're all found when you stop thinking and you feel rather than think. Which is why all the wise people have never been the thinkers, are being the silent, silent sages. They're the ones. That's why we always say these professors, we always have these stories about professors in Buddhism. And if you're a professor, you better leave now, because the professors always end up, you know, wrong. I said, you know, a couple of weeks ago about the professor who went to the 5-star restaurant. Did I say that? He was out in Malaysia recently. I'll say it again anyway. Professor went to the 5-star restaurant, opened up in Perth, had to make a reservation, took 2 months to get the reservation. And when he actually went there, there was a very tough dress code. He had to dress in a very, very fine suit. He went there, they checked his ID. Yes, sir, you got a reservation. So he managed to get inside this very top restaurant. They took him to the table. The decor was something out of this world. Incredible decor. Chandeliers, beautiful, tasteful interior decoration. And when he got to his table, which was thick mahogany with a, you know, silver candlestick on top, and then when he went to the table, the waiter came and gave him the menu. The menu was in thick parchment, not just these ordinary menus like you get in McDonald's. I mean, the really thick parchment, gold calligraphy, the whole works. And so the professor said, thank you very much. He took the menu, ate the menu, paid and left. The reason why? Because professors don't know the difference between menus and food. Do you understand what I'm talking about? It's just all the thoughts. Yeah, they can be an expert, you know, on Buddhism. They may have read all the books, but they don't understand a word of it. They're just people who eat menus. They don't taste the food. I think you've got the point in there. Now, you can understand what I'm talking about. If you just taste menus, what happens is you get the menu, you translate it into so many different languages, you do a PhD on the different menus available in life. And when you do the PhD, then you become a professor and an expert on the different menus, the menus of Australian food and Aboriginal food and sort of Chinese food and all the different. You become a menu and become very famous, become an advisor to the government on food, but you never ate any. It's very stupid, isn't it? And those are the people who do all the arguing. So if you have an argument, you'll always be arguing with someone who's just read the menu, never tasted the food. People tasting food, they never argue. That's why the Buddha said, no, I don't argue with people. People argue with me. How can you argue with the meaning of peace, the meaning of love, the meaning of harmony,
the meaning of even truth. How can you argue with that? You don't argue these things. You realize them. You know them. You live them. If you're arguing with them, it shows you don't really know what you're talking about. So that's why people would come and argue with Ajahn Chah and he would just laugh at them. And it's a wonderful thing when people laugh because that totally dismembers any argument whatsoever. One of the famous arguments, you know, from this was a famous argument from the time of that 5th or 6th century AD Buddhism. You know, people would actually go into these debates because in the time when they didn't have TV and they didn't have movies, like getting, you know, two great monks or something to have debates was actually great entertainment. And so they had these two monks were debating and they started off by saying, the one monk said to the other, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm Mahanama." And the other monk said, "Who's Mahanama?" He said, "I am." "Who's I?" He said, "You." "Who are you?" "I." "But who's me?" "So you're a dog." "But who's a dog?" "You are." "But who are you?" "I'm Mahanama." And if you got that, this guy was calling the other man a dog, and this other man was just trying to get into the idea of the sense of self and what a self was. And the two were just totally different. One was from experience, and the other one was just, you know, in his head. Now, a lot of times that's a problem with people, and they don't listen to each other, and they don't listen to the emotions, which is what goes on between each other, what goes on between you and life. That's where the peace lies. So if you really want to find out truth, I mean, forget all this argument business. It doesn't really get you anywhere. It just gets you really upset, and you don't have to be right. So being wrong is being at peace. Sometimes there's certain things you do and you make mistakes, and it's wonderful to make mistakes. That's why I always like telling people the mistakes which I make in my life. I was telling people, because somebody asked me, I was in Kuala Lumpur last weekend, that's why I wasn't here to give any talks, and sometimes people ask me, just, why do you monks always chant in this foreign language? It's called Pali, it's a dialect of Sanskrit. And I let them into the secret. The reason why we chant in a foreign language is because if we make mistakes, you don't realize it. Because we're the only ones who knows this language. And it's true, because I did a confession that once I did this marriage ceremony here in Perth, and I actually chanted the funeral chants instead by mistake. I did. But they didn't know at all because it was in Pali and they didn't know what I was talking about and chanting. So I totally got away with it. And the marriage still holds. It's still going well, even though I did a funeral chant for their marriage. Well, that's one of the reasons why we do this in chanting foreign language, so no one else knows what we're talking about. So we make mistakes and let people know. And that was such a wonderful thing to know, that you can be wrong, you can make mistakes, and it doesn't demean your personality or your sense of self at all. In fact, it increases your worth. Too often we think if we make mistakes, our worth is diminished. It is not. It increases your worth. That simile which I gave in my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, when you make mistakes, you know, the two bad bricks in the wall, very quickly I made my first wall. Two bricks were crooked. I didn't know how that happened because I was a perfectionist. I tried my very best to make those wall perfect. Because of those two bad bricks in the wall, I got so upset I wanted to destroy that wall. I dreamt of that wall and woke up with like a nightmare. Oh my God, I made a big mistake. For 3 months I suffered. Every time I saw that wall, I thought of those two bad bricks. Until one day someone came along and said it was a beautiful wall. I thought they were crazy. They were blind. Can't you see those two bad bricks? Yes, we can. But we can also see the 998 good bricks. You know that story. And that was the first time I could see the good bricks. But the reason I went that first part of the story very quickly is many of you know that. I gave that story at the Cancer Support Association in Cottesloe. And this builder came up to me and said, "Look, don't worry about that. All bricklayers make mistakes. It's okay." But he said, in the building industry, he said, when we make a mistake like that, we tell our clients, which is you, we tell our clients it's a feature and we charge them an extra couple of $1,000s for it. And I thought, what a wonderful ending to that story. Because making a mistake is your feature. Your worth grows up, not down, when you make mistakes. And that is so true to life. You know, if I make a mistake, you know, you laugh, it makes me more human. It makes the whole, you know, the lecture here much more fun. You know, if someone else makes a mistake on TV, I remember when we went to this big ceremony in St. George's Cathedral, you know, interfaith ceremony with the governor there, and there was a bomb scare. You know, somebody, some fool rang up and said, no, you can't have non-Christians in St. George's Cathedral. I'm going to blow the place up with the dean and the archbishop in there at the same time. And that was a wonderful ceremony because it all went wrong. No one knew what they were going to do next. And it was the first time in years we started talking to each other. When is a mistake? It's wonderful. She's not here this morning, but or this evening. Jenny, who usually sits in front over here, when her husband, Steve, died, we did their funeral in Fremantle Cemetery in the open crematorium where, you know, you're on the outside, not in one of the chapels there, and you put the sort of the coffin on the conveyor belt, and, you know, you press a button after the chanting and the conveyor belt takes it inside, you know, the door opens and it closes again. But these were white water rafters, and it was my mistake. I told them, you can build your own coffin. You can do that. That's actually, you know, allowed, you know, with certain regulations. So they got the size right, but they built it out of Jarrah. Jarrah is incredibly heavy. And so when they put it on the conveyor belt, and after all the chanting, they pressed the button, that poor motor just could not cope. And it was struggling to pull, you know, this very, very heavy coffin. And the motor for this sliding door was a separate motor. So that opened, but when it closed, the coffin was only halfway through. And so it slammed against Steve's coffin and got stuck halfway in, halfway out. Now, feel for those poor funeral directors. I mean, they look pretty glum and depressed at the best of the times, but now their depression on their faces went to another level. The funeral had got stuffed up by Steve getting stuck halfway. But we know what Jenny did? His devoted wife, in grief for just losing the husband she loved so much, she jumped on the conveyor belt and started pushing. And all the friends said, are you trying to get rid of him that quickly? Trying to push him. And of course, that really started it off. That was the best funeral I've ever been to. People were laughing, they were joking. One person said, yeah, you know, Steve, when he got his first car when he was young, he crashed his first car on the first day. The first day in his coffin, he's done the same. People later. And that was a wonderful time, because when it makes a mistake, it adds this beauty to life. So that's why mistakes are beautiful. Being wrong is great. So if you're wrong, please admit it and enjoy it. It gives you features. You don't have to be right. So you don't have to argue. Say, yes, you're right, I'm wrong. And you have such a peaceful time. And as far as I'm concerned, you're a much higher person. You're much closer to Nibbana the more times you're wrong. The more times you're right, the more egotistical you are, the more conceited, the further you are from truth. Just like me. Now, I tell you when I'm wrong, so I'm really humble. I am the most humble monk you might ever see. In fact, I say, if you're humble, you must flaunt it. I want to put an entry into the Guinness Book of Records of the most humble monk in the whole world. I'm only joking, of course. But this is actually how you do things. Okay, I made a mistake, have I, again? I admit it, I'm wrong. Okay, he's made a mistake, I think. Admit it, you're wrong. So anyway, this is supposed to be the questions coming from overseas, which is somewhere. But anyway, so that is where arguments come from. Remember that arguments, it's not worth having an argument with a person, except if it's just for fun. I mean, if it really is for fun, like my Flat Earth Society, or sometimes we have an argument, you know, you say it's yellow and I'll say it's black just for the sake of fun. Have a nice little argument together, but it's just for fun, okay? Don't take it seriously where you get emotionally involved, and it's so important you're right. Demand
demand that you can be wrong. I demand the right to be wrong and to be admired for being wrong and to be elevated as the most humble person for always being wrong instead of thinking you're a loser. And also remember that what is really right and wrong is just not whether you're arguing, but it's just how we can put all those information together so we can get closer to the truth, not by arguing, by combining, like the simile of the elephant. And also remember what is really right, what is really wrong, is what leads to peace and harmony and truth and freedom. Those are the qualities, what leads to Nibbana, if you like. The Buddha said that if it leads to Nibbana, it leads to peace, it leads to harmony, it leads to letting go, then that must be the truth. So you don't argue the truth, you feel the truth. And you know what it is. Just like I knew what peacefulness was and what silence is. And you know what love is. You don't need to argue. You need to feel it. And then we can have a much better life. No arguments, no more wars. Husbands and wives living together for a long time without bothering me when everything goes wrong. And having a much happier time. So that's the talk this morning. No arguments. This evening, rather. Thank you for listening. Now, somehow or other, the machine has gone wrong. Usually there's questions coming from all over the world. But this evening, unfortunately, the Pope can't ask a question. So any questions from over here? Yes, Annie. How would I improve our parliamentary system?
So that it could operate without having argument.
Okay, first of all, no more parties. I don't know why they call it a party. I used to like parties. It's got nothing else to do with what the sort of parties I went to when I was a kid. So no parties and just have individuals. And also, I've said this before, the way we elect politicians is in what they promise to do for us in the future. In the word candidates, which is all the people standing for election are called candidates, that comes from a Latin word, candid, meaning white, and because that was what politicians would wear in the Senate, or before they were elected to the Senate in Rome, they would wear white to show that they were standing for election in the Roman Senate. And they would wear white as a symbol of their past purity. How many politicians in our government would deserve to wear white? And they'd be elected on their past conduct, never on their future promises. That's number one. Please, we should never elect our politicians on what they promise for the future, on what they've done in the past. That'd be much better. Okay. Okay, anyway, so that's one thing we can do, so we don't have argument. And also so that people actually listen to each other rather than arguing at each other. So one of the reasons is if we had parties, then we got votes and who becomes, you know, which party is in power, rather than we can get the best from both sides. So we shouldn't really have parties. I should ban all political parties, just have individuals standing on their past records. Anyway, Mark from Melbourne, Ajahn Brahm, how can I stop my kids arguing with each other? One way is to use masking tape, you know, around the mouth. Just put a little hole in there for the straw. But being seriously, the reason why your kids argue with each other almost certainly is because you, Mark, and your wife argue with each other, just imitating you. That's what monkeys do. They imitate the elder monkeys. So they learn that from somewhere. So where did they learn that from? You know what I learned from my parents? Yeah, they would argue with each other, but we lived in this tiny apartment in London. They'd argue with each other, but they couldn't escape from each other. That was a wonderful thing about being poor. You didn't have a big house where you could sulk. So they had to meet each other. They couldn't escape from each other, which must have driven them crazy. But so after a maximum, maybe an hour and a half, and then my mum and dad would make up.
And that was a beautiful part. Yeah, you could argue, but they also knew how to make up. And they made up in front of myself and my brother. And that was wonderful to see. Yeah, you know, it's argument. Yeah, we're human beings, but we make up quickly. So what you should do, Mark, is have an argument with your wife. Just stage one in front of the kids and then make up and have a hug and kiss and take each other out for dinner. So your kids can realize, okay, they can argue, but they must make up pretty quickly. The making up is really important. That shows you that arguments, it puts the arguments in perspective. Oh, they're just not really important. The making up is important because that's the peace and the love. That was what creates harmony. So, you know, what I want to see in the parliament is see Tony Abbott and Julie Gillard have a nice big hug. Oh, I love you, Tony. Oh, yeah, you're just my favourite girl, Julia. Wouldn't that be awesome? Mona from India. How to handle arguments when involved in legal court cases with close relations, especially when the other person is overly aggressive. No, you're really in big trouble now when it goes to legal court cases. So you should never get to that, you know, that point. But sometimes that people are just so selfish, what they really want is all they can really see. So it is difficult when other people are just like that. So sometimes you've got to protect yourself as much as you possibly can, you know, for these stupid people who just want to take everything from you. But okay, they may take your money from you and your house from you, but don't let them take your humanity from you. Don't let them take your love and forgiveness and happiness from you. But hopefully that sort of, you know, it doesn't cost that much. But anyway, look, if they do take everything from you, you know, they take your house and all your money and everything else, you can still become a monk or a nun and be happy. That's your last resort when you've got nothing left. But if you're already in the legal court case, if there is any possibility of making a settlement out of court, sometimes that's a wonderful thing to do. If you can find a mediator, someone who can tell the other person and yourself, look, you know, what are we doing this for? We're family. For goodness sake, can't we sort of make some sort of agreement? And if family can't live together in peace and harmony, what hope is there for this planet Earth, you know, to actually live together in peace and harmony? And sometimes all it needs is just, you know, the family, if they've got like a parent. Because, you know, especially in Asia, they respect parents so much. Just out of love for your mother or your father, you know, you come together. I remember there was doing one funeral service for an Australian family. The old mother or something died. And so some of the sisters, they came together, hadn't seen each other for about 10 or 15 years, had a big falling out and argument. So this, your mother's died, I told them. Look, for the goodness sake, out of love and respect for your mother, make up. It was wonderful, they did. Just because out of concern for their mother who just died. Sometimes you just need that catalyst. For some reason, say, oh, come on, it's more important that we put aside this hatred, this ill will, who's right and who's wrong. There's some things which are much more important than that. And once you realise those priorities, winning the argument is not important. Being able to live at peace together with, you know, your family or your husband or wife, isn't that more important? Of course it is. So please remember that. Anyway, Pat from the Netherlands. When a couple are from different countries and different cultures, we both think our ways of doing are right. How do we compromise? Very easy. You actually combine rather than fight. There was some years ago, they're not here this evening, there was this Catholic Italian married a Buddhist Thai. And after their marriage, they came to, no, it's my predecessor, Ajahn Chakwa. What should we do? Now, the Thai girl said, should I become a Catholic? Oh, no, the Italian said, should I become a Buddhist? What should we do? And the monk gave this brilliant piece of advice. He said, listen, the two of you, on Sunday, I want both of you to go to church. Both of you, the Thai Buddhist as well, you go to church. On Saturday, you both come to the Buddhist temple. You, Catholic, you come here as well. So you do things together. So you, the husband, the Italian Catholic, you can learn how your wife thinks where she comes from, why she does the things she does. And you, the Thai girl, you can learn how your husband thinks, where he comes from, what his culture is. Learn. And then you can have the best of both worlds. But the most important thing, to do it together. So if you're from different countries and different cultures, don't just have, you know, if you're from Netherlands, what do people in Netherlands eat? You know, potatoes or whatever? Pancakes, thank you. You have pancakes. And the other person may be, say, from India and has curry, so you have pancake and curry. Put the curry on top of the pancakes and eat that. You know, you can actually join the cultures together. I did that once. The Sri Lankans tried to make me some Western food, so it was, they made me East meets West shepherd's pie. It was potato on top, Sri Lankan curry underneath. That's terrible. But anyway, so we both think our ways of doing things are right. Okay, Pat, you are right, but not correct. Pat, it could be a girl, it could be a boy, but your partner, it could be the same. But anyway, Pat, you are correct, but not right. Your partner is right, but not correct. Because if you're having arguments, combine. And remember the most important part, it doesn't matter what culture you come from, doesn't all cultures respect harmony and peace and love instead of being right? So please remember, the most important thing is, you know, you're a couple. It's us. It's about the love between you, the care between you, the harmony, the forgiveness between you. That is what is important. That's what you should be doing. As long as you're creating peace, creating harmony, creating love, creating those things, and that is truth, then you are right. If you're creating disharmony, arguments, then that is wrong. So that is way of doing right and doing wrong. It makes it very easy. So that is the solution. You heard it from here. So now we can have a peaceful, happy world.